One mic, one voice. You can change the world, it's your choice. One mic, one voice. You can change the world, it's your choice. One mic, one voice. You can change the world, it's your choice. One mic, one voice.
The One Mic, One Voice show, building the collective conscience, a show that is created to give space where your voice, ideas, and informed opinions can be heard, appreciated, and yeah, debated. I'm Michael Eric Owens.
And I am Deshaun Thorne.
Oh, man, you know what? We're going to dive right in. Okay, it's a beautiful day.
It is.
It's a great day, but, you know, there's so much discussion surrounding the condition of the Black community. So many, you know, and we're doing some revisionist stuff here, right? Because last week we were talking about the flag and bringing out the true history of the third stanza, and where it talks about slavery, right? Been getting a lot of good feedback about that. And so we're gonna be revisionists here today and talk about how the Black community was created into a ghetto. That it was not a quote unquote, a group of folks that came, didn't want to work, that were lazy, didn't want to take care of their property. And so therefore their community descended into these blighted areas.
I think a lot of people have taken on the idea that these things just happen out of thin air. Like they happen on, like I have a nephew, he's 5. Mm. And if he gets in trouble or if something happens, you know, ask him, you know, what was going on? His answer is, you know, it did it by itself. I think a lot of people have taken on that ideology about a lot of things that are happening right now. It just did it by itself. Yeah. So there are reasons why, you know, Blacks see themselves in certain areas feeling hopeless when these things were created to be that way.
Well, and I think to broaden the discussion, we're going to see where the federal government, state and local government, worked in concert to create these areas, talking about redlining,
legally redlining,
where one neighborhood, you know, where they did this, the federal government did this study, this kind of a real estate study on value of real estate. And how white communities were seen as more economically sound because they didn't have Black people in it. And if you had 3 or 4 Black families in it, then actually banks in the federal housing, that you could not get a loan because Black people were in there. And so they created, the federal government themselves, this division of this geographical division, which caged in a group of people who could not get loans, okay, who could not improve their condition. And then we're going to talk about these buyer contracts that were used, these predatory lending that was used against Black people, that finally, when they start opening up these white areas, and it's deep, it's a creation. So when we say that the inner city is an American problem, it's American creation. So when you say, well, them Black people, they tearing up their own community, folks, America created communities like that. That's what this show is about today. So we're going to get deep. You want to get deep, bro?
We might as well.
We're here.
We're in the studio now.
We're in Black and Studio,
yeah,
right?
No,
so we might as
turning back.
Well, listen, folks, when we come back, we're going to come in with a video that I think will begin to outline our discussion today. And so when we come, we're going to come right back in, Richard, with the video. Not welcome back, but folks, we're going to come right back with the video. We are in Black and Studios. We're excited to be here.
Episode 52.
Episode on the other side of 50.
Okay.
We will be right back.
What's up, guys? I am Leah Marie, owner of The Selfie Gods. Make sure you head over to our website, www.theselfiegods.com, and order your very own selfie moon. If you need that good lighting whenever you out in the club or you out hanging out with your friends and you need some more light for your selfies, that's definitely what you want to get, the selfie moon.
To Levittown, and we found the model house, and we walked in and we looked around, and of course in the eyes of a young man who was raised in the ghetto, so to speak, it was an interesting experience, interesting lifestyle, seeing all the new modern conveniences. Very fascinating.
Eugene Burnett came home with almost a million other black GIs. They had fought for the country in segregated ranks. They returned hoping for equality and the American dream. For many, that dream was a new home for little money down and some of the easiest credit terms in history.
I went up to the salesman. We're interested in your home. We're interested in buying one. And what is the procedure? Is there an application to be filled out? So forth. So he looked at me, looked around, and he said to me, he says, listen, it's not me, but the owners of this development have not as yet decided to sell these homes to Negroes.
It was as though it wasn't real. You can't imagine. But for someone to come out and actually tell you that they can't sell to you. You know, I was really on an up. Man, look at this house. Can you imagine having this? And then for them to tell me because of the color of my skin, I can't be a part of it.
The FHA underwriters warned that the presence of even one or two non-white families could undermine real estate values in the new suburbs. These government guidelines were widely adopted by private industry. Race had long played a role in local real estate practices. Starting in the 1930s, government officials institutionalized the national appraisal system, where race was as much a factor in real estate assessment as the condition of the property. Using this scheme, federal investigators evaluated 239 cities across the country for financial risk.
So that those communities that were all white, suburban, and far away from minority areas, they received the highest rating, and that was the color green. Those communities that were all minority or in the process of changing, they got the lowest rating, and the color red. They were redlined. As a consequence, most of the mortgages went to suburbanizing America, and it suburbanized it racially.
The racial logic adopts the principle that an integrated neighborhood is a bad risk, is a financial risk, that an integrated neighborhood is likely to be an unstable neighborhood, unstable socially, but therefore also unstable economically.
When the white residents of 8 Mile Road in Detroit were told they were too close to a black neighborhood to qualify for a positive FHA rating, they built this 6-foot wall between themselves and their black neighbors. Once the wall went up, mortgages on the white properties were approved. Between 1934 and 1962, the federal government underwrote $120 billion in new housing. Less than 2% went to non-whites.
I can understand an individual, depending on his environment or his family or whatever, being racist, but for your country to sanction it, give him tools to do that. There's something deadly wrong there.
Wow. You know, the video speaks for itself.
Yes, in so many different ways, man. Land of the free, home of the brave. America.
I mean, the hidden history
yeah.
of how minority people have been done in this country. The lack of historical knowledge and reference to from which this country has come, and our decision making based upon what we see and what we what lack in our understanding keeps us ignorant, keeps us from engaging in conversation that is healthy, that is enlightening. I mean, when you think about a black person seeing a home that they want and being told we can't sell to you.
Nah.
But you I have a job, I have money.
Got credit.
We're talking communities, not just homes. We're talking communities that you, simply because of the color of your skin, sanctioned by the federal government, state government, local government, that you are not worthy enough to live in this neighborhood. And if you live in this neighborhood simply because of the color of your skin, you will bring down the value of everyone's property here.
The guy says something about creating a social unstable community.
Mm.
And I thought about that as you know, if blacks are to move into a white neighborhood, who's going to talk to them? Who's going to communicate with them in a way that makes them feel comfortable back then? So I see what he was saying, you know, about creating that kind of social instability. But at the same time, how do we expect, you know, people who have really just got on to the idea of being integrated into the communities, into society anyway, being okay with then having to share a community or a space with them just because we're all supposed to be equal now?
Aren't we talking about humans? Mm-hmm. I don't know, man. I don't think I'm from an alien species. I mean, somebody help me out. I mean, maybe, you know, maybe I landed came from a spaceship or something. The planet, man, we're all human beings, man. And this idea that because of the color of your skin, you are better or you are worse, and that we continue to battle over this.
And what's funny to me is that we can't really even have, well, we do. But a large part of even the conversation when you talk to blacks about getting a new house today, it's like, well, you know, what neighborhood is it in? You know, do you live around other black people? And that's still something that comes up in conversation.
Well, I know you hear that. Exactly. Exactly. Because, well, it's rooted. It's rooted in something cultural. It's rooted in fear and acceptance and the fact that, and it's also rooted in a certain kind of, I would say, internal racism and the fact that you don't live around your own people. You know, why are you living out there? Why are you not living in the hood? Why are you not, you know, I mean, so that's a whole nother conversation. Yeah,
it's to that point that you made about us even having healthy conversations about owning a home. That's really a significant accomplishment in the lives of people today. Like when you get a house, that's a big achievement, you know, and so that's something that's important to people. But at the same time, we don't know that back history of us being shut out and not really having opportunities to even be in nice places. And those people back then, even willing to make the sacrifice to not be around other black folks just for the opportunity to be, you know, integrated into a quote unquote better neighborhood.
Well, look at it like this. The landscape is equal. Okay. Pre ghetto. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so the federal government comes in and says, you know what? Because of their outward racist tendencies and their inward implicit biases, decides to have this color scale, right? Green is good, red is bad, okay, somewhere in the middle. And what we're going to do, we're going to make all of these all-white neighborhoods great. Banks can give money there. But these black folks, these are multi-cultural neighborhoods. Nah, we're going to make them high risk. Banks are not going to give money there. Over time, what happens? One community booms. another one dooms, right? And so what happens is then you bring in, and we're going to take a break here. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about this contract buying. But then you have blacks that move into former white neighborhoods. But they don't really own a home, though. Okay. The white owner still owns the home, contracts with them. But when they miss a payment, he can just take the home back. Okay. Because they really don't have a mortgage. And these speculators are making 15% profit off of these contracts. Okay. But you know what? Those black folks in the ghetto, they don't care anything about they. Look, they just didn't tore it all up. Look
how they trying to treat their neighborhood.
Yeah, they just don't care, do they? Nah. Huh?
How could we dare let them into our neighborhoods?
Wow. Wow. Folks, this is American history. We know we got people listening from all over, but I'm sure there are similar situations even in your own country. But what we're talking about here is why we have these. And get this. DT, this is kind of the outcome of what we see, this creation by the federal government, by society. Now we see the violence in these communities. So they were victims from the start, and now they're victims in the end. Because what was created to cage them in, and now all of a sudden you have this amount of violence, and they say, look at these people. They're killing each other. What about black on black crime? What about police brutality? What about all these things? Well, these environments were created. And I guarantee you, you could create this environment for any group of people, and you would get the same results regardless of what color they may be. Bro, we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back.
This is Richard Taplin, host of Black in Studios, The Black Box. Join myself and Elijah Bailey as we discover new ways to self-improve ourselves. Also, we interview podcasters and local entrepreneurs. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram at Black in Studios, and also come to our website, blackinstudios.com. You can find all the podcasts I record here. And remember, it's Black in.
This is Dr. Paul Ketchum, and I fully support One Mic, One Voice, and I recommend you do the same.
Welcome back to the One Mic, One Voice show. You know, this next video, man, you either laugh or you cry, right? I mean,
I was thinking the other day, man, we are facing like so many different problems, and like Facebook is like a therapy almost, because you can get on Facebook and just laugh your head off for hours right. at the stuff people are doing and saying and, you know, kind of putting on there. But it's like, we don't spend as much time really dealing with what's happening. Mm. And that kind of escapism doesn't allow us to deal with it on a real level. Mm. It's like, man, I might as well just get on Facebook and laugh it off, man. Cause like you're saying, it's much better to do that than to sit there and be so upset and so sad and so, broken down about the reality of what's happening around us.
I think people just probably zoom right past my post.
It's like, no, Mike ain't got no jokes on him. Next.
Keep going. Right.
Next.
Man, I don't want to read that. Nah, I'm tired.
Post too long. Who got time to be thinking about all of that? Like, man, you should take some time to think a little bit.
Yeah. Hey, you, I'm going to congratulate you on posting.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank
hold on. Okay, Richard's over there. Yeah. We finally got to
come from the heart.
Man, you got a lot of great response from that post, man. And, so we get on DT cause he don't post enough. So we get on him and try to get him to get, more.
But this is my season. I think I was looking back in the past years, I guess like way before 2011, maybe I was posting a little bit more often.
Oh, okay.
And I was in August and September, like my times when I was posting stuff, cause you know, it'll tell you like on this day, you know, you posted this. I was like, man, I was really active on Facebook a while back. This is my creative time. This is the time.
You're more active when you're out of the country.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're more active. But see, you can't lead no
more,
man.
It seemed like there are more interesting things going on.
You can't lead no more, man, because almost lost the show last time when you left.
Did we get a letter? Yeah, somebody write in?
Some people protested outside and stuff.
But it's luckily, we didn't have a studio back then. We were kind of low key.
Exactly. We're in a mystery location back then. Right.
Richard Tyler would have been flagging, like, man, that's not even his fault. I'm sorry, Richard. We're sorry, man.
Exactly. So this video, this is about contract buying. Home buying contracts in Chicago. So I want you to take a minute and just listen. It's about 7 minutes. However, it's extremely informative. Stay with us. Hopefully you got your special mix. Cause we don't.
I'm drinking the water.
But stay with us and we're going to have a conversation.
I come to buy this house because I was looking for a place, you know. I was just looking for a house. And I happened to look at this neighborhood and had to look at this house. And my wife liked the house. She liked the house. So we contacted the guy who owned the house and got together with him. And met with him on Pulaski Road. He had that office over there. And gave him the money and come in here. Took out a contract. The house was $26,000. The house didn't cost that much at first, you know. The house was less than $26,000.
Do you know how much he paid for the house?
Oh, he paid $9 for it.
This was a contract. Right. What does that mean?
Sounded like a mortgage. But the owner still owns the house. And he sells the house to you on a contract where you're responsible for all the costs. All the electric, all the upkeep, and then in the notes. But when it comes to the mortgage, you're not a mortgage. You own the house. The seller still owns the house. See? And so, if he want to kick you out, if you miss one note, he can kick you out.
What was the damage? The kind of damage done by contract buying?
It created a ghetto. It wasn't contract buying that did it, it was contract selling. Back then, we used to think of it solely in terms of the harm that it caused to individual families. In the fact that it required husbands to work 2 and 3 jobs, wives to work, which meant that kids had to be left unsupervised frequently enough. And there wasn't enough money to keep up the houses that they bought. White folks were claiming that they were irresponsible in terms of keeping up their places when the fact of the matter was that it was costing them twice as much to own a home, the same home, as if they were white. And that's because of the fact that they were buying on contract, that the speculators came in, bought at basically market value or slightly below from the outgoing white families, and then turn around 2 or 3 days later and would sell to a black family on contract at close to twice of what they paid for it.
So how much was your monthly payment?
$260 a month.
And how much were you earning?
$70 a week at Camel Soup.
So how did you manage?
Well, I worked at the pizza place, and I worked at the post office, or any other job I could find. Still hard to make the payments, see? Still hard. In late 68, we finally met a guy named, my name was Jack McNamara. He came out of the Catholic Church, and he was interested in this neighborhood. And he come in and give us a big assistance.
I was a community organizer, and we worked to assist contract buyers in obtaining justice by doing the research and helping with organizing people, etc.
A lot of people didn't want to admit that they had bought a house on contract. because a lot of people thought that they had bought a house on the mortgage. We decided to try to find out, get some education on where we was and what situation we were in and how could we get out of it and what could we do. You know, we didn't know what to do, really. Finally, we met and made an agreement to stop paying the sellers. Don't pay them another dime. Now, that's a lot of money that the sellers were getting, you know. Well, the results of that, the sellers come screaming to us, say, hey, we want to talk. Say, well, you know, we make a settlement. Not of a settlement, we made a settlement, you know.
How do you feel about it? Do you feel proud of what it accomplished?
Yeah, I feel proud of what it accomplished, but all things that dots me is that we didn't hold it up, we didn't keep it going.
What do you mean?
Well, everything you get is cost. The cost is terrible in this neighborhood. See, we should have been setting up an organization that's going to maintain these people who have been cheated, you know.
Recently, I became obsessed with the idea of trying to find out how much was stolen legally from the African-American community during the Second Great Migration, which was 1940 to 1970, and on the basis of pretty good research, have come to the conclusion that it was at least a minimum of $500 million. And that is $500 million not adjusted for inflation. If you adjusted for inflation, it'd be well over $3 billion today. Basically, white folks created the ghetto. The dominant culture created the ghetto because banks wouldn't loan, FHA wouldn't loan, the federal government was only benefiting middle-class white people. There's a direct link between the crime that exists today, between the education gap, between the slum conditions, between joblessness, and all the rest that we're so horrified about the ghetto. And the problem is that the dominant culture did it.
Wow. The dominant culture did it. Those words stand out to me.
So it didn't do it by itself?
Didn't do it by itself. It wasn't by osmosis that it happened.
Predominantly happening in Chicago?
No, this ghettos all over were created by no matter what city you were in. You can go to St. Louis, you know, go to Milwaukee, mm-hmm. Chicago, New York, DC, Baltimore, wherever you go, wherever there is a minority community. Okay, New Orleans, mm-hmm. Baton Rouge. Wherever there is, this was a creation by the federal government, state, local government, which was ran by the dominant culture. And we sit back and we go, look at those people tearing up everything. Mm-hmm. When we created it, mm-hmm. we created that hostile environment. We created that black community. And today, man, you look at all the thriving downtowns we have. Go around the country. You know, downtowns, they show off, man. They buildings are.
That's the place to see
something. Oh, man, you know. But what's right next to the downtown?
Okay. Yeah.
The black community, minority communities. We're spending all that money downtown, but we won't build up that black community. Banks still today will say, well, that's high risk. You know, I might not get my money back, but there's a reason. Banks were part of the problem. And then you come around and you demonize the very people that you put in that situation. That's like me caging up a lion and not feeding the lion and then criticizing the lion. But when I try to put my hand in, he tries to bite it off. But I created the cage and I didn't feed the lion. Right. But look at the lion. He's out of control.
Yeah, he's a mess.
Okay.
He's ferocious.
Wow, folks. I'm here to tell you.
You know, I've I've experienced being around people talking about their mortgages, mm-hmm. and even people up in their 80s, black people who have refinanced for the third time, who fell up under one of these contract selling situations. So at first, you know, trying to get out of the ghetto, trying to move into a nicer neighborhood, they set up a contract, you know, to have a house. But come to find out, they were never paying towards owning it. And then finding that out and having to refinance and then, you know, building your credit up to refinance again. Yeah. So at 80 plus years old and still not owning the house, still making payments on the house.
Wow.
So that's how deep this is, that it's been that long. So I'm 30 years old.
Yeah.
I remember going to my grandmother's house when I was 5 watching cartoons, you know, and at that point they were still paying on the house. And now even up into elderly age are still working on paying for those houses that we're trying to, you know, supplement moving into a better community.
And I can tell you what, they have, the person that owned it has made a killing.
Yeah, they've probably purchased it 4 or 5 times over by now.
No doubt. I mean, it's criminal, right?
Legal stealing.
It's crazy. Folks, hey, those videos speak for themselves. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we have a extremely special guest in the studio with us here today. It's been a long time coming for him to come to Blackened Studios, but he has finally opened up his schedule, pinned us in, and showed up today. And so we're looking forward to having a great, great conversation. Folks, stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey humans, this is Emily Stengel.
And Elijah Bailey here from the Hoya The Warrior Way podcast, a martial arts podcast diving into the world of martial arts one kick at a time, the warrior mindset in a wild bunch way. To find us, you can go to
our official Facebook page at Hoya The Warrior Way podcast, or go to at Hoya Warrior Way on Twitter or Instagram. And you can always find us at www.blackandstudios.com, where you can click on our link and have access to all our episodes.
Hi, I'm Professor Jim Smith from Southern Nazarene University, and I just want to plug in for One Mic, One Voice. I've learned so much from the discussions that they put out there, and I couldn't recommend a better podcast.
Welcome back to the One Mic, One Voice show, Building the Collective Consciousness.
Special guest.
Special guest, Professor Jim Smith of Southern Nazarene University. He's a faculty member there. He teaches mass communication in the Division of Culture and Communication Studies. Jim is a personal friend of mine, so his bio is extensive. Me and DT have had the honor to come and share with his class. But Jim is a creative artist. He's not only a professor, not only intelligent, not only passionate, okay? And his theme last year was love, empathy. He teaches his students to empathize, which I think is one of the greatest qualities that anybody can learn. But he's also, man, you know, he's the creator of our website.
And so many other things that we have now.
You know, I mean, just like all of our branding. He created our logo.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, like, you know, I was thinking when I was coming to the studio, I was like, Jim has been with us since the start.
The photo shoot.
The photo shoot. I mean, when we decided to have a podcast, the next person we turned to was Jim. Mm. And we didn't give him any, seriously, we did not give him any idea of what we wanted anything to look like. Am I lying?
No, you didn't.
Okay. And every time he was like, what do you think about this look, man? We just like, dude, you gotta be kidding me. This is
perfect.
Wonderful. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? It was like, perfect. Oh my God. And then when we did the photo shoot, you know, we shared a little bit about the concept and man, I tell you, people love our website. Yeah, is classic.
It is. It's nice.
It's classy. It's timeless.
Another thing about the logo is that we were going to have a few different
variations,
but we seen the first one. Like, that's it. That's the one. Right. Don't need to look any further. You got it. Right. And that felt cool, man. I was like, wow, this cat knocks it out the park on the first try, you know. Right. And everything since then has been an A1. Oh,
it's been great. And so, Jim, Professor Smith, welcome to the One Mic, One Voice show.
Man, it's great to be here. I hope I can live up to that intro there, but thank you so much.
The 5-minute intro. Yeah. We should have brought out the band playing in the background, you know. But no, Jim, you have been such a great instrument in the development of this show and all your expertise. I mean, even, you know, posting the shows on the website, and the images that Jim chooses. I mean, man, it's just you are a class act. I'm gonna be honest with you. I know some people that try to do stuff. You know what I mean? I know, no, you're doing some stuff, man. So we just really appreciate having you here. And we wanna in a minute get into kind of talking about the course you teach, and me and DT can talk about the experience we had coming and sharing and kind of go into what you're doing right now with your students, but also and a little bit about what happened last year at the university. But you've been sitting here for a minute with us, and you know, the first part of the show we were talking about some very challenging things. Any thoughts?
Well, the thing that kept running through my mind watching both of those videos and hearing your commentary is just how easy it is to think, oh, these things are all in the past. But that priest in that second video really brought it to today, and how what we're seeing in these neighborhoods that, like you said, we want to say, oh, look what they're doing to themselves. Those all stem from the problem we created. Absolutely. The lion we caged and failed to feed.
And the idea of $3 billion being lost to the black community.
Exactly.
I mean, that's amazing to me. And the fact that like DT said, we shouldn't be shocked over this, because our federal government has always, and for good and for ill. I mean, when Civil War took place and brought the troops in to protect the Freedom Riders. And, you know, there's good, but there's some ill there, too. And the federal government did some terrible things to minority people throughout this country. And this happens to be one that still plays a role. I can say this right now. When I moved to Oklahoma, trying to get a loan for a house. I got good credit, man. Had already built a house and sold a house. I go in, man, and count it. I'm a veteran, right? GI Bill. I mean the VA loan. There you go. But being a veteran, the VA loan guarantees payback. I had lenders telling me, man, I need to come up with $30,000 and this, that, the other thing. I'm like, well, dude, number one, my credit's good. I got the VA loan. The way I got my loan in Oklahoma was online.
Really?
Was online. Hmm. Now, somebody might say that's just coincidence. I had went to 3 separate lenders and got the runaround. I do it online, I'm automatically approved. Thank you, Bank First. Bank First treated me like I was royalty. Mm-hmm. And you know what I'm saying? Like, it was ridiculous to me, because I was sitting up saying, you got to be kidding me. So what is the issue here? Well, I mean, what I'm saying is.
Yeah, what is the issue here? I mean.
You know what the issue is, okay?
It couldn't have been you being black. That couldn't have been the reason. It had to be the gray eyes.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
Green eyes.
It's
eyes
like, man, this brown dude with gray eyes. Okay, we couldn't really tell what he was.
He's not going to pay us back. Even though he's got the VA loan. Even though he's already had a house and sold a house. Okay. I built my first house. Okay. So I mean, it was crazy. And I'm making decent money. Right. So it's not about income. It's not about credit. Okay. It's not about financial history. What is it about? Okay. Three different lenders. I do it online. I'm instantly approved. Boom. I build my house, buy my land. No problem. Okay. I'll say some off mic later on, but I don't want to blast nobody. But what I'm saying is these issues, I think, are still present today where people.
A veteran.
Even though people have all, they've checked all the boxes, there's still discrimination, man. Don't think they're not. And this was a direct creation of our government. And it continues to plague us today. Now, Southern Nazarene University had an incident about a year ago. Jim, why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we we had a young man who decided to, you know how for dances and stuff like that, these kids these days, they want these big outlandish invitations to invite their date to the event. And so we had an event on campus called Heart Pal. And so this young man wanted to ask this young lady out. And he thought the way to do it would be to dress in blackface. And he had a sign made up. And that's the way he did his invitation to this young lady. And immediately posted it on Instagram. Got a lot of really positive feedback about it. Everyone thought it was really funny. And immediately some people on campus were going, this did not happen. This could not have happened here. And it was a very black mark for the university. But at the same time, it opened a floodgate. And some of our students of color were suddenly coming forward and say, hey, this isn't the only thing that's happening on this campus, and we want to talk about it. Mm. And to the credit of the university immediately opened up a dialogue. There have been a lot of disappointments along the way since then. Some people feeling like that the university is not doing enough. And that's still going on. But I'm encouraged to some extent because the conversation is being had. Mm-hmm. Now, this semester has gotten off, for me personally, off to a little bit of a rocky start because I've got some students who don't want to have the conversation, mm-hmm. who have challenged me and say, why are we talking about this? Why are we doing this? And so that's frustrating to me. But at the same time, there have been some good conversations. And so what started off as a negative event has the potential to be a learning event, which at a university, you hope that's what's going on.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, what better place to have these conversations than the halls of intellectualism?
And now he's creating a safe place. That's a rarity, you know, because it's not common that you find professors even who are willing to challenge and address those kind of issues, even in the face of what students may think about it. But just to be able to provide a safe space is even saying something about the potential to learn about these issues and what's really mm-hmm. going on with this.
Mm-hmm. You know, the question is, why are we talking about this? Why not? I mean, I don't.
It's not funny. That's why.
Well, but I mean, what else would we talk about? I mean, this is where we meet. This is where we exchange who we are and what we are on a daily basis. This is where we have been. And this is where we're trying to go. And if we don't talk about it, if we don't have the conversation, if we don't overcome these differences, then it's still there. I mean, yeah, you know, it's like you can't run from it. You know, America has been trying to run from this since its outset, and we're still here.
Okay. Exactly. Exactly. I think one of the things that I have found and in my own personal development, I used to be one of those guys that didn't want to talk about it. I don't want to talk about this. This is painful. This is uncomfortable. And with that went some degree of denial too, that, these things exist. And what happened for me is just allowing myself to ask a simple question. What's wrong if this happens? What's wrong if we have the conversation? What am I going to give up just by having the conversation? You know, I don't give up anything. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, last week in your podcast, you talked about getting over our insecurities. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a huge, huge issue. And so this semester, one of the things that I really tried over and over again, because I'm getting this pushback and I'm trying to say, what do you give up just by entertaining another person's perspective? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, in communication, one of the things that's so, you know, it's my favorite thing to talk about is human perception. Mm-hmm. And where do our perceptions come from? They come from our experiences. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you and I don't share 100% of the common experiences mean that you and I have different perspectives, different perceptions. We see the world a little bit differently. But what empathy says is, I try to see the world through your glasses.
Yeah.
And I don't judge it. You know, I don't judge it. I just listen to it and try to feel what you're feeling. And through that, I can build a bridge to you instead of putting up a wall.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's what we're trying to do.
That's beautiful, because I mean, this, you know, I think when people disagree with somebody's perspective, it's simply because they want to, you know, they want to control that which they believe.
Their way to be the right way.
And I think when you infer that to somebody, as Jim say, when you do not judge, and this goes back to what we were saying, you know, on this very simple analogy, if I offend DT and DT comes to me and say, you know, Mike, man, you offended me. And I was, man, I didn't offend you. Instead of me saying, okay, how did I offend you? And even if I don't see it, that's your experience.
Exactly.
So I have to accept that, you know, whether I believe it to be true or not, it is your experience. And I think it is so easy to deny somebody else's experience in the way they feel, in the way they see things, simply because we don't see it or feel it. That's what it boils down to. It's a very, I think it speaks to insecurities. I think it speaks to just, you know, a vulnerability that we don't like having, you know. So in other words, I didn't offend you, so I might not see it, but now I got to apologize, you know. And I really don't want to apologize because I don't see it. You know what I mean? So you just need to just, you know, don't wear your feelings on your shoulder. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that keeps me safe. But now when I'm vulnerable, I say, man, DT, I'm sorry, man. I didn't mean to say that. I didn't mean to do that. Now I have really put myself in a position of vulnerability. And I think as most human beings, the ego prevents them from doing that.
That's true. Yeah. I think ego's huge, huge in this whole thing. And that, you know, what's wrong with saying I'm sorry? You know,
it is
a vulnerability, but really, what am I giving up by just saying I'm sorry? Even if I don't think I did anything wrong, sometimes it's okay to say I'm sorry, because that is your experience.
Absolutely.
And whatever I did somehow impacted in your experience. And I don't want to be the cause of that pain. And I want to keep this bridge I have to you.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what my students, I say, you know, you can hang on to your ego all you want, but you have to accept you're giving up relationship by doing that. You're giving up the opportunity to have a meaningful relationship with another human being. that's a choice you want to make, you can make that choice, but I'm going to choose to have as many meaningful relationships as I possibly can.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like that idea of that bridge to someone else, you know, because that bridge has got to be maintained. You know what I mean? It's like anything, right? I mean, you, and it's two ways, man. It's one way across and one way back. And I think, when you put others ahead of yourself, then that can become a goal. But when it's about the self, you burn the bridge. I mean, because look, we just not getting along. You know, I just don't see the things, see the world like you see the world. So we just go, boom, I just lit the fire, you know. But if I really want to have a meaningful relationship with you and press through all of that, I'm going to try to maintain, as you say, maintain that bridge. That requires two people.
It's like a marriage, right?
Yeah, it is.
A great deal of compromising and understanding and trying to get another person's viewpoint understood so that way you can live together, you know, so you can be together.
Yeah.
A lot of us have triggers, things that bother us that don't bother other people, but that doesn't mean that they're not justifiable or that they don't really mean something.
Yeah.
And so having a heart of vulnerability, being able to receive somebody else, help build that bridge up, allow somebody else to come into your viewpoint and say, man, look, I get that. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not happening to me, but I get that.
Yeah.
I can see that. And a lot of us have, man, we have some wild experiences, you know, like things that really shake us and shape us and they hurt, you know, and it's like, I have to carry that with me. I don't have to, boil it over into anybody else's life, but I have to understand myself to the point where I know what's going to trigger me to act a certain way or to respond a certain way to somebody else. And I know that may not have been their experience, but this is me.
Yeah.
And now I have to teach people about how to interact with me in a way that is as safe for both of us. I heard you talk a few episodes ago about, you know, having friends in your life who, you get into it about, you know, just any issue, you know, and it's like, man, we bigger than this issue. Yeah. You know, you my friend, we grew up together. Yeah. You're my boy, but this can't be dividing us to the point where, you know, we're not seeing eye to eye up until this point. Everything was good, you know, and so we need to open up to say, you know what, man? Yeah, I see that, you know, because we're all still growing. And I think a lot of people don't respect that in each other. It's like, I can't, even if I haven't talked to you in a few years, I know that you're not the same Mike I met 2 years ago. You know, even today you are different. Even today you are thinking about something new that you weren't thinking about 2 years ago that has changed you. And I have to respect that. I can't see myself as a person who is, not growing but looking at somebody else who is in envy.
Yeah.
Like, man, Mike tripping now. He's gonna start reading all these books and thinking too much, man. He ain't the same Mike we see. You know what I mean? But it's like, man, don't try to diminish my growth just because it's uncomfortable for you. Take a chance to learn something or to be able to open up yourself to understanding me just a little bit more.
Absolutely. Building that bridge. Folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to take what Jim has been talking about and relate it to this whole issue that we've been dealing with in this show about the creation of ghettos. And how the country can empathize and understand this in a way that can be healthy. They can be allies in this fight toward equal opportunity and equality. So, folks, we're going to take a break and we'll be right back.
Thank you for downloading this episode. Here on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Google Play Music, or whatever podcasting library you're listening to this show on, please rate and review. Those reviews and ratings help us tremendously. We thank you.
This is DT of the One Mic, One Voice podcast. Just want to let you guys know you can go over to iTunes and search us at One Mic, One Voice and be sure to rate and review our episodes. Let us know about any feedback that you have and what you enjoy about the episodes. Also, you can go over to Stitcher where you can get the latest and freshest episodes of our podcast streamed directly to your smartphone or iPad. No downloading or syncing. How cool. Real smooth. Also, we'd just like to take the time to thank you for your time and for your energy and for spending time with us as we discuss the historical record of our time.
Welcome back to the One Mic, One Voice show. So as we begin to wind down here, we want to bring this thing back around, Jim, and kind of talk about this empathy. I grew up in a, if you want to call it, the ghetto black community. I don't live in the ghetto. I live. I'm rural, folks. I'm a farmer now. Yeah. You know, I got few chickens, you know. but there's a black community without borders. But not being situated in there. I work in the black community each and every day. But let's talk about how empathy can be used to understand in light of what we've learned from the show today. The creation of these ghettos were from the federal to the state to the local government, redlining, contract buying. So how does empathy play a role in helping us understand and move this conversation forward?
Well, the thing that keeps coming back to me as I hear that story for the first time today, had never heard that before, is where are we today as a result of that happening, you know? And these communities that we all know about that are run down, where people, you know, they don't have pride of ownership because they don't have any ownership, you know? And that, what do I give up if I just take 1 minute, you know, one brief moment and say, what does this world that we share look like through that person's glasses? And if I can allow myself to do that, then I might go a step beyond that and say, okay, what needs to be done next so that we can rectify this?
Yeah.
You know, it's not enough just to acknowledge, yeah, this is a bad situation. We got to go a step further and say, what can we all do? And I think that's the biggest question I keep asking myself and I'm trying to grow in is thinking thoughtfully about what my responsibility is to address these cycles that occur over and over of people who grow up in poverty and who can't seem to break out of it and the things that the system does to keep them there instead of helping them break out of it.
Absolutely. So, DT, what through those glasses, what does the world look like? You work with young kids all the time.
I think a lot of the people you say this generational kind of relapse. It's like the parents are not starting off in a positive direction. You know, like you're already behind. So how do I even give the people that are coming behind me the skills, the tools they need to really thrive and survive in a society like this if I didn't get them myself from the people who came before me? Like, luckily, you know, I had programs, I had mentors, I had all of these different things that my parents didn't necessarily know about or could help me do without them. And so the education is one thing, but having resources is another thing. And through those eyes of not being somebody capable of providing that for another person, your child, it limits you in your ability to help them go further than you went.
Dismo.
And so I was having a conversation with a father, right? And he worked as a janitor his whole life. His daughter is getting ready to graduate from high school. She's a sophomore. But looking to now figure out what it is she wants to do after high school. Her dream is to become a marine biologist. You know, to her dad, who was a janitor, that sounds very fancy. That sounds, you know, kind of out of reach, out of touch with what's really happening, what's going on. And he asked me, he's like, man, you know, I think she should just, you know, get a trade or something, you know, to learn how to weld, to learn how to woodwork, to learn how to, you know, do something that she can actually do. And then so the mentality of the father is that my child is not even capable of being a marine biologist. I don't even know what that is.
Wow.
And so how does that apply to her being successful if I can't even wrap my head around marine biology or science or some of these other things that are going to help my daughter become whatever it is she's trying to do? And so that even is a crippling effect for children who have big dreams, but their parents kind of shut them down because they don't have that same confidence in themselves or see their children as people capable of achieving those things.
Wow. That is so sad. I'm going to be honest with you. I mean, wow. I mean, just think about if we cannot place hope and vision into young black and brown kids, if you can't see it, you can't achieve it. And to simply say, this is where you're at, simply say, this is our standard for you, they will never exceed. And the sad thing is that low standard we set, they won't even reach that. The experience, you know, Jim, as you talked about, being able to see what that experience is like, and then to go beyond that and say, what is my responsibility to help change that? I mean, clearly, these communities were not the creation of those who live in them.
Okay. Exactly. Yeah. There's, I think education, and that's what I'm trying to do in my classes, is one way. And it's not just educating students of color about, you know, pursuing your dreams or whatever, but I think the greater responsibility I have is to help students of privilege to understand that privilege, to accept that privilege, to not be threatened by the fact that they have privilege, but to use the privilege then to make a difference, and to fight against a system that denies that privilege to others.
It's like we talked about Father Flagrant and this reverend who got involved in these Chicago happenings. It's like that's what it took for there to be some change, for somebody to take it serious about what these black folks are trying to do.
Yeah.
For somebody not of color to step up and say, man, this ain't cool. This ain't right. Mm-hmm. We need to be doing something about this. Let's organize. Let's get together and figure out what we can do to move things forward, because you guys have been trying it and you haven't been getting the response you want from it. Let me step up and take responsibility for my privilege to be able to help you.
And that's what the allies are all about. You can go all the way back to Thaddeus Stevenson and Charles Sumner doing Reconstruction and how they pleaded with Lincoln to free the slaves. These white, you know, senator and representative from Massachusetts, and how they took up the cause. I mean, Frederick Douglass had talked to Lincoln multiple times. He couldn't persuade him. The reality is we live in a culture where white people are privileged. But as Jim said, you can use that privilege to be an ally for change. When Jamie came on the show, she talked about how that privilege can be used to make a difference when you stand up for black lives, when you stand up for inequality, when you stand up. Just like there was a video on Facebook where this particular man, I don't know if you saw him. He looked like, you know, he was living on the streets, but he actually wasn't. He worked at this house in this neighborhood for this attorney, this white attorney. And this black, like, security person had called the cops, and the cops showed up, and they were trying to arrest him. And she was like, what are you talking about? You can't arrest him. You can't do anything that you're trying to do. That's a violation of his rights. And he has been working for me for the last probably 20 years, I think she said. And she grabbed him and took him to the house and wanted the cop's badge number. Why? But she was in a privileged class. It's that. Listen, folks. it's going to take all of us in order to bring about change. The ghettos, they're a creation of United States government. The lack of loans and funds to rebuild communities and home ownership, that's corporate. That's corporate. That's the banking system. That's the financial system, the redlining, all of that, folks, allowed black people to be marginalized and demonized in this country. But it can be changed. It can be changed. It can be overcome if we understand our history and we come together to make a different future for our children. Because history will speak of us. Somewhere in the future, a scribe will reach down deep into the archives of our time. And what will she find? Will she discover that we overcame our differences? Will she find that out of many, we became one? Or will she find that we saw nothing and remain a divided peoples? Yes, history will speak of us.
We can make a difference if we try. We can be the change that's in our lives. All we gotta do is work together. We gotta raise our children better. We gotta stop the hate, and spread the love.
One mic, one voice. You can change the world, it's your choice. One mic, one voice. You can change the world, it's your choice. One mic, one voice. You can change the world, it's your choice. One mic, one voice. You can change the world, it's your choice.
Your choice.
Today's broadcast is being brought to you by Blacken Studios. To learn more about Blacken Studios, please visit them at blackenstudios.com or visit them on their Facebook page, Blacken Studios. Today's broadcast is also being brought to you by Perry Publishing and Broadcasting. To learn more about Perry Publishing and Broadcasting, please visit their website at perrypublishingandbroadcasting.net. The opinions of the One Mic, One Voice show do not reflect the views of Blacken Studios or Perry Publishing and Broadcasting. Thank you for downloading the One Mic, One Voice show.